Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in itself. G'day, Sally.
G'day, John. How you doing?
That's like when you say g'day like that, it sort of sounds like there might be a wink involved.
Yeah, it does. Was there a wink involved? I don't think I looked quickly enough.
No, you were looking in the wrong direction.
Now, do you know that I am talking to you from another time and another place?
I know.
Yeah.
Like we deal with all sorts of time realities and time warps and bends and... Yeah.
We do, and
that's
we're having one
Brody's
right at this moment.
Hair is standing on end.
Poor Brody. Yes, because as our listeners, some of our listeners may know, of course, you did the show last week, and what a marvellous job you did of it. And this week, I'm still away in San Francisco, so we're going to repeat a show that we listened to a little while ago. And the reason we're going to repeat it is because the interview that we did with Paola Di Trocchio about her exhibition 200 Years of Australian Fashion was great, and the exhibition is still on, so we figured that it was worthwhile playing it again.
Indeed.
And we're going to be replaying you too, John. Do you know what you'd be talking about this week?
I would hazard a guess.
Yeah, go on.
That I'll be talking about staggering around Hampstead Heath and finding my way to Blossom's house and Ginger Baker for dinner.
Exactly. Well done. That's good. That's a very good recall. Of course, Cliff will be in, and we're also going to we will update the news at the end of the show. So even though the body of the program's a repeat, there's going to be some new news at the end. So while we get in the mood and get the thing playing, here is David Bowie and Fashion.
And now it's time for John On.
Thank you, Swanee. You know, sometimes I hear that sting in my mind, perhaps at a dinner party or somewhere.
Do you think, am I talking too much?
When I was in London... there was a friend of mine from Melbourne who'd gone to London and married.
Yeah.
And I had a phone number and an address for her. And I'd rung her and said, well, we're over in Hampstead and you should perhaps give me a call. I mean, so you should perhaps come over and why don't you come over, you know, tonight or whatever it was, and because we're having dinner with some people and you can join us. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I attached, of course, Hampstead to Hampstead Heath.
Yes.
And got myself to Hampstead Heath and thought, well, I'll find the house from there, thinking maybe it was like Princess Park or something.
Oh, no, it's a little bigger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wandered around past Kenwood a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Did you pop in there?
No.
Some good paintings in there.
I was getting late.
Yeah. It was probably closed.
Got lost, in other words.
Yeah.
Went over the top of the hill a couple of times, had a look around.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually made my way down into a bordering street to the Heath in Hampstead.
Yep.
And
got to the right side.
Got to the right side and found the house. And it was a very large English terrace, stone, and it had a great big front door on it.
Yeah.
With an iron knocker, you know, I knocked on the door and it made a sound like there was a very large stone hall on the other side of the door. And a young lady opened the door for me, and there was in fact a very narrow passageway full of books on either side. Leading up to a staircase, and she said, they're all upstairs. So I went upstairs. Remember that film, With Nail and I?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Was it a bit like that?
It was a bit like
that.
There was this long...
Uncle Monty there?
...dining table. Well, it was mainly like that because the kitchen, which was at one end of the dining room, was in a parlous state, I'm afraid.
Was it?
The saucepans and plates and stuff piled up all over the place. And this man with massive mutton chops and a tweed jacket on, very English.
Very Uncle Monty.
Yeah, sprang to his feet and he said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm Blossom's friend and I've come for dinner. And Blossom sprang to her feet when she was at the other end of the table, and we said hello to each other. And her new husband, who was mutton chops, said... Welcomed me to the house, and he said, I want to show you something before we do anything else. And he led me back downstairs and he opened the door to a room. And in the room was about maybe 15 or 20 cellos.
Good heavens.
And he said, I'm a musical instrument dealer. And these are all Jacqueline Dupre's cellos, which I collect.
He collects Jacqueline Dupre cellos.
Yeah.
Right.
And he said, this is my collection. And he said, we're having dinner tonight because it's my group of friends who are all collectors of one sort or another. It's a collector's dinner. And I said, oh, I didn't know that, but I'm looking forward to meeting a few of those characters and talking about their collections. And he said, well, I'm sure you'll enjoy yourself. Upstairs again, and I sat down at the table next to a man who was very tall and he had a little shock of red hair on the top of his head. He was wearing a pinstripe suit and a shirt and tie and had a series of stick pins in his lapel and a thick Scottish accent. And we had a lovely time talking about all sorts of things. And I asked him during dinner, these are all collectors, I've heard, you know, you collect something. He said, I collect manuscripts, musical manuscripts. I said, oh, okay, so like Bach and that kind of thing. He said, no, contemporary things. Like I own, for instance, the bit of paper that Tambourine Man was written on.
Really?
And I said, oh, that's pretty interesting. He said, yeah, I've got probably half a dozen Bob Dylan songs, some Richards and Jagger material, and he said quite a collection. I think he mentioned something from... Simon and Garfield. Simon and Garfunkel. And all of which fascinated me, of course.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. He sprang to his feet before the pudding arrived and said he had to go and ran from the room. And I finally got to talk to Blossom. I said, who was that guy? He's an interesting guy. And she said, well, that's... Oh, man, I've forgotten his name. Isn't that incredible?
It's not going to be Malcolm McLaren or something like that.
No. He was the drummer from Cream.
Oh.
Ginger Baker.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I'd had dinner with Ginger Baker
without even knowing.
Yeah, and without even being able to remember now.
There must have been a lot of red wine consumed.
Oh, presumably.
Yeah, fantastic.
And the next day we enjoyed Hampstead, saw Ginger Baker again out there. You know, they do all that sort of very English stuff around there, like have ploughman's lunches.
Yeah, they do at the pubs and things like that. Mm. Oh, I love Hampstead Heath. Did you go swimming in the ponds?
No.
That used to be part of mine. Yeah, I've only got 3 minutes, the lap says Brody.
Well, I also, on another completely, another vein, Amanda and I went to headquarters recently and... We went and had a look at the painting, portrait of the mother.
Oh, Whistler's mother.
Whistler's mother, which I think is in fact called Study in Grey, is the real title. It's always just been known as Whistler's mother or Portrait of his mother.
Yes, that's right.
Portrait of the artist's mother or something like
that. She looks grim.
It's a kind of tedious picture, I have to say. Mm. And I do, as a rule, very much like Edwardian paintings, but I think I prefer Singer Sargent to and that type of painting, which is a little bit airier and a bit sort of brighter. And Whistler was, particularly in that painting, was very grim. Mm. It is very grey and black. It's beautifully handled, wonderfully made. But really, I think, just makes me wonder why it is that some paintings become much more notorious than others. Some of Singer Sargent's paintings, for instance, of society women in London, are much finer pictures, but don't have the notoriety that Whistler's mother has. I think the Americans kind of ran with it because whilst the painting was... Whistler was an American who lived all his life in Europe, and he made that particular painting in America and was known in America as a famous American in Europe. And so they picked it up as an American painting. and ran with it and put it on biscuit tins and all sorts of things, and it became famous. So there's always a backstory to a painting's notoriety, I suppose.
And why is it part at the NGV at the moment?
It rarely leaves the D'Orsay Museum in Paris where it resides.
Yeah, so
and,
it's just
it was an opportunity, I think, but they might be like restoring a part of the building or something over there, and it had to go somewhere, so it came to the NGV.
Right.
And they built a kind of a little bit of a display around it and some information rooms and that sort of thing. Mm. But I've never seen a public gallery show one painting.
Yeah, I guess because of its notoriety, you're right.
I guess so, yeah. They'd do the same thing with the Mona Lisa, wouldn't they?
They would, if they're allowed to have it.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, in a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to Paola Di Trocchio about 200 Years of Fashion, and I'm a little excited about that because I got to relive a little of my youth in there when I went on the weekend, because in the 80s I went to live in London, and as well as following my dream of working in the theatre, which, as everybody knows, cannot pay any bills, and London's pretty expensive to survive in. So I got a job with a production company producing catwalks for the British Fashion Council and London Fashion Week. And the reason I got that job and was allowed to work in the UK for as long as I did, which was nearly 9 years, was that I had a lot more experience than most at my age, because I'd cut my teeth on catwalks and fashion shows here in Australia in the early 80s, on the Fashion Design Council's alternative fashion shows here in St Kilda, and the Australian Fashion Awards for the Wool Board, working under the tutelage of LSD Fogg. So when I went to London, and a production company was pitching for the work, I was a natural fit. There just weren't that many people who were doing it, and it was in 1983 that London actually became part of that big catwalk scene in the world, and it was just great timing for me. So it was fashion photography was really big, and the designers were competing to create the biggest buzz, and real theatricality was appearing on the catwalks, and we did it first, folks, here in Australia. So while I was working with John Galliano, Jasper Conran, Vivian Westwood, Betty Jackson, Catherine Hamnett, Kate Moss and Naomi Campbell were on the stage, and Boy George was making the soundtracks. Yeah. It was pretty exciting. So listen, while we get Paola Di Trocchio on the line to talk to us about the Australian Fashion Festival exhibition here, here's Right Said Fred with an oldie but a goodie that pretty well sums up backstage at London Fashion Week.
You're not going to play Boy George?
No, I'm too sexy. Right now, there's an exhibition on at the NGV in the Ian Potter Centre Gallery, surveying 200 years of Australian fashion. And in it, there are clothes from the very early days of Australian colonial settlement, as early as 1805. And it also includes some exquisite examples of tangible life in Australia. And as you snake your way through the exhibition, you can't help but realise how much the clothes say about the people wearing them. And you're forced to consider what our choices and styles reveal about us today through this context. To flesh out the exhibition for us today, curator of this wonderful collection and also of fashion and textiles for the NGV itself, we have Paola Di Trocchio on the line. Good morning, Paola.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for talking to us today on Arts About.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Paola, I visited the exhibition yesterday and was really amazed at what a sociological journey it was, loaded with world dynamism and the emergence of the Alarican Australian spirit. It's a great collection. Tell me, what are your highlights? What do you consider to be the main themes of this exhibition?
Well, the exhibition itself traces key moments of Australian fashion, and of course, within the context of Australia. So, as you say, characters like the Larrikin are present throughout, and there are moments, I guess, where the Larrikin emerges. But I feel like it's a bit of an undertone that is present throughout the whole exhibition. And I guess another important part of the exhibition is focusing on and looking at how Australia exists in relation to the greater world, because of course we're looking at and thinking about fashion, which of course is not unique to Australia, and for a very long time is completely dictated by places like Paris and London, not just for Australia but for the broader world. So it's about thinking about how Australia fits in that global dialogue, mm-hmm. and then moments where there are very characteristically Australian moments that occur within that dialogue as well.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so interesting to see because at the very beginning of the exhibition, of course, there's these really old costumes, pieces of clothing that have been worn by settlers who quite clearly are demonstrating their conformity to a European heritage. And you see as you walk through the additions to that or the modifications to that, which must be as a result of climate and financial fluidity and presumably also, in fact, I think I did read location to the east where all the beautiful silks and things were available.
Absolutely, yeah. That first dress that you're referring to is from 1805, and that uses Indian muslin. So that's referring to, I guess, Indian muslin was fashionable throughout the Western world in the early 19th century. But Australia is at an advantage at that point because they are geographically closer. They're also importing Chinese silks. And then as the cities within Australia emerge, develop, and I guess particularly following the gold rush that occurs in Victoria, there's enormous economic growth. Places, shopping palaces, emporiums, department stores are built and they become symbols of a metropolis. So they're not just a place to shop, but they end up having quite a civic role in the construction and the profile, I guess, of different cities. So we've got examples from Petty's, which is in Brisbane, Brighton Hitchcock, which is in Geelong, and various other department stores around the country, Farmers, which is in Sydney.
Buckley and Nunn,
yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. That beautiful dress, that 1805 dress, was, curiously enough, worn by a friend of the show, historian Jonathan King's great-great-great-grandmother.
And wow.
Yes, so I've actually sent him a photograph of that this morning and said...
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if he would know about it. I'm sure he probably would, but... yes, to alert him. He lives in New South Wales. But I was fascinated, particularly that dress. It's so incredibly tiny. And I wondered, looking at a whole lot of the dresses there, I wondered, what about the body shape of early colonial days? There were really high busts. There were tiny waists. There were little people and the sloping shoulders. Were the dummies reflecting fashion ideals of the time, or have our bodies themselves evolved with the variations in our lifestyles and health and activities, do you think?
Well, I guess it's a combination. I think, the clothes themselves, I guess, dictate in a lot of ways the mannequins that we choose. So the very exaggerated shoulder line that you are referring to, I think, in the 1855 dress, although there are a few, but I think that's the most pronounced, that actually does follow the lines of the dress. So I guess we can tell from that that shoulders were particularly sloped at that stage, but it was also bodies conforming to fashion archetypes. So the corseted silhouette, I guess, in particular... in the early 19th century, the bust line was incredibly raised, and that was raised with the use of corsetry and a particular shape and style of corsetry, which did raise the bust line to that particular height.
I noticed that in quite a lot of the costumes there, that when they were talking about the construction, there was quite a lot of whalebone or baleen in them.
Yeah, and that was typical of the 19th century, and women were, or I guess children, you know, began to wear corsets, and that would have had an impact on the shape and the formation of their bodies, and particularly their torsos. And then it's in the late 19th century that murmurs, I guess, begin to occur around the dangers of corsetry. And there is actually a dress in the dressmaking and tailoring section, which is almost kind of medieval-looking, almost it's very red, it's quite dominant. It's an example of aesthetic dress, which is reflective of this time when there were a number of people, I mentioned physicians, but also artists and I guess, you know, forward thinkers thinking about different ways that women, I guess, in particular could dress because of the dangers around corsetry. So one of the models that they looked to was medieval dress as something that was looser as a model. But of course, interestingly, the shape and the form of the dress still does fit over a corseted figure. So it's not it's not really until the 20s and the 30s that the corset as such gets abandoned, but then there are still different types of corsets that are worn in the 20s and 30s to achieve that very linear look that's fashionable.
It was such a relief, actually, to walk into that next room and see the corset's gone and real bodies there again. You know, can almost breathe out. Because the constraints of those high collars and the bustles and so on were phenomenal. Now, I always think that fashion is such an interesting art in that it interacts so directly and obviously with current social trends and social mores and morality and economy that you can tell so much about a society by looking at it. And I think it's really apparent to absolutely everybody. There's no kind of of course there's academia involved in it, but anybody can look at these things and actually learn an enormous amount of the people that were wearing them.
And I think that's what's so fascinating about it. I mean, two moments, I guess, that are quite particular to occurring in Australia are, you know, one being in 1965 when Jean Shrimpton wore the mini dress to the Melbourne Cup.
And freaked everybody out.
Sorry, to Derby Day. It ended up being quite representative of the conservatism that was present within Melbourne at the time. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it also became quite reflective of the energy and enthusiasm that there was for, you know, this new youthful spirit, because the mini dress ended up being adopted almost overnight.
Yes.
And then there's this other major shift in 1973 when Jenny Key opened her boutique Flamingo
Absolutely.
Park.
Absolutely.
And all of a sudden there's this absolute celebration of Australian motifs, all the things that are completely unique to this country.
Yes.
So it happens then because Jenny Key's been travelling. She's been in the UK largely, and she comes back and she sees Australia with fresh eyes. And there's also a political and economic climate that's particular to Australia at that time that sort of embraces this freedom as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's when, I mean, certainly for me, that's when things got really exciting, because all of a sudden it's just a completely different direction that is so absolutely Australian. It was very exciting, you know, turning the corner and going into that room and seeing them and that video of Jenny Key and Linda Jackson speaking, and then walking further into the next bit, which was then part of my world, my youth and the 80s and the fabulous filmmakers that the Fashion Design Council, and, you know, it all took off in the modern world for me at that point.
The filmmaking is incredible, isn't it? We actually, that was original footage from the actual parade.
Yes, I know, because I think I mentioned to you the other day that I actually worked in that world, and in fact, Jo Lane is a great friend of mine, as was Simon Burton, the two filmmakers that that did those shows. And
oh, fantastic!
Yeah, and I would have been at those shows or been part of, been, you know, lighting those shows. It was very great because I was involved with Robert Buckingham, Kate Durham, and Robert Pierce of the Fashion Design Council. So we did those shows in the 80s, so, and then I went on to London to kind of work over there doing that bit, because London took off too at the sort of the same time.
It just seems like there was, I mean, we interviewed a lot of the designers, well, a selection of the designers from the FDC, and they just talked about all the energy and all the enthusiasm and all the kind of creativity that seemed to be so much a part of, I think, the 80s in general, but particularly as part of the Fashion Design Council.
Yeah.
It was actually really inspiring to speak to them all, and it was great to be able to record their words and their impressions, because they all had very different experiences at the time. They all sort of entered at different stages. Yeah. You know, Christopher Graff coming straight out of school. Cara Baker had, I guess, a semi-established career, or at least, you know, a whole lot of skills that she brought into her, you know, design practice through the Fashion Design Council. But the variety, I have to say, was what really excited me, and that focus on independence and creating and celebrating their own styles and voice. But the Fashion Design Council just creating an umbrella, I guess, in order to all work together.
Because it was here, really, in Australia, that the hunger for fashion shows was taken to another level, and the catwalk shows became mainstream entertainment, open to the public. Yeah. So how do you think that has impacted on the industry? Because it must really have had a significant impact.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, the Fashion Design Council was a forerunner to, the next sort of iterations, which were Australian Fashion Week and Melbourne Fashion Festival. Yep. So in 1996, Simon Locke establishes Australian Fashion Week as a way to celebrate Australian fashion for, within an international context. And I think that FDC really is a precedent. And I think you also, can see that too, considering Robert Buckingham was absolutely instrumental to FDC and then the first director of the Melbourne Fashion Festival.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, of course, both are still running today and both incredibly strong. And the outstanding feature, I mean, apart from the excellent parades that are part of the Melbourne Fashion Festival, but from the very beginning, the cultural program has always been a really important part of the Melbourne Fashion Festival. And that's something that we're seeing into Fashion Weeks in other, I guess, regions. Mm-hmm. Discussions about fashion and the presentation of fashion through exhibition as opposed to only the one format, which is the runway presentation. So it's interesting seeing that growth in that area around fashion presentation, which isn't, the runways are fantastic forum, but also looking at other forums.
Mm. Well, it's a fantastic collection and a fantastic exhibition. You deserve to be congratulated. Thank you very much. 200 Years of Australian Fashion is on at the Ian Potter Centre. It opened March the 5th, I think, and runs until July the 31st.
That's right.
There's a book.
There is a book.
There's a book that's available for sale, which looks amazing, extraordinary photography and all the information that backgrounds a lot of what we've talked about and more, of course. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Paola Di Trocchio. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me.
See you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Our resident critic of most things, blogger of many, and favourite member of the Arts About team, actor Cliff Ellen, joins us once again at his rightful place in front of the golden microphone. Good morning, Cliff, and how are you this morning?
Good morning, Sally. Good morning, John.
Morning, Cliff. Where'd you appear from?
What's that?
Where'd you appear from? Just came down on a ray of light or something?
No, look, I'm really grumpy this morning.
Oh, dear.
It's just...
in a thunderclap, perhaps.
Back, John.
You're allowed to be grumpy on radio.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's a rave.
But I had to have something done on my feet, and I saw that morning show while I was waiting. I think it was 9. And they were so happy. I was talking about the Queen, and she must have turned 90 or something.
Oh.
Oh, you know, that's nice. She's a lovely lady.
Yeah.
We all need Lizzie, our Queen. But
yeah, we do.
They gush. I suppose if I was on television, I wouldn't be allowed to be grumpy. I could be grumpy on radio.
I think it'd be much more more interesting television if you were on television and you were grumpy. I'm sick of all these sycophants.
Than those two people. I don't know who they are, but I mean, you've got to look at something while you're in the waiting room, have your feet done.
Well, actually, I hate that. I'm actually was in the doctor's surgery last week, and they didn't have the regular magazines that they normally have there. They had the television on, and you're forced to watch drivel. I'd rather read drivel.
Well, we see a lot of drivel anyway, you know, in a country that's over governed to blazes.
Yeah.
We could watch Malcolm. He was in China, wasn't he? Talking about AFL football.
Oh, missed it all.
Oh, no, well, that's very funny.
Well, the AFL, I'm sure, would love to promote themselves into China.
They would, yeah. Mm. What about promoting a match into Tasmania? You know, they're amazing. They really are. They go after money. As if we're going to play in China. All right, they might play in China.
If they paid them enough money, they would.
I've got a cough too.
Lovely.
Storyboard Entertainment.
Yes.
Announced that Bert and Patty Newton will play the roles of Theodore and Emily Whitman, ex-vaudevillians who perform an old routine from their days in the Follies.
Oh.
Directed by Tyron Park, starring David Hobson. I love David Hobson. Lisa McHugh, Nancy Hayes, Philip Quast, Anne Wood, Deborah Byrne, Cheryl Baker and David Roger Smith. It's a really good cast for those people who like that stuff. We all know I hate musicals. Or recitals or whatever.
What's the play called, do you know?
It's at the Melbourne Recital Centre. Yeah. Oh, you said this last week.
I
don't know what they're called. Storyboard Entertainment. Yeah. That will do it.
Oh, okay, very good, yes.
They do it, you know. It's on two nights, May the 24th and 25th.
Okay, well, it sounds good. It sounds very interesting, particularly given that the cast is so good.
It is a good cast. Mm. Nancy Hayes and Lisa McCune, I think they're great. There's another one a long way off. What's that one? Billy Crystal.
Yes. You know,
hosted by Andrew Denton. When is it? It's August 1st and 2nd, but booking's already open.
Really?
A lot of people like that sort of thing. They think Billy Crystal's funny. So I'm giving it a mention. Billy Crystal's all right, I suppose.
He did, didn't he host the Oscars, or was it the Oscars, quite a long time ago? He was quite good at that then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Mm. He has he sort of relies on a fair bit of relevance, community relevance or social relevance, so he'll have to do a bit of research, I would have thought, before he comes out here. And
but he quite often uses the audience too. Mm. But even in the Oscars, he's done that, you know. And it can be interesting if you like that sort of thing. I've seen him do stand-up routine on television. I fell asleep, but a lot of people must have liked it.
Johnny Depp was out here, Cliff.
Oh. Johnny Depp.
Yes, answering charges about his dog.
Well, his wife was charged.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought that was interesting.
He's only a little fella, isn't he? I'm not keen on little fellas.
Oh. Really? I'm only a little fella, Cliff.
I was in the car park the other day. No, today, this morning.
Yeah.
A big Range Rover came along. I gave away the Range Rover. It's the size of Australia.
Yeah.
And who do you think was driving it? A little Filipino girl. And she got out and she's about 4'8". Mm. I immediately thought, this is terrible. I love little Filipino girls. I would love to see a husband. what have we got?
I went cold for a moment.
Yeah, no, John and I just froze momentarily.
Miss Julie, 16th of April, 21st of May.
Now that's got that lovely that lovely man whose name I can't.
Mark Leonard Winter.
Yes, who was in Birdland.
Yeah, got the Helpman Award with it, which means nothing because that's a Sydney thing. Directed by Kip Williams.
It's a Strindberg play, of
course. Strindberg's theatrical masterpiece, the MTC, and a modern revival.
Have you ever seen it before?
No, I didn't see it.
No, I've never seen it.
But I wouldn't mind seeing it. Robin McLeavy is in it, and Zara Newman also. Mm. So that's okay. Another dreadful musical, The Sound of Music, is coming.
You've got to be kidding me.
We're all in on the edge of our seats on the... What is it? May 13th, I think.
Yes.
Well, I saw Sound of Music, the musical. I thought it was fairly boring, but I still think the film itself had a lot of good stuff.
Oh, the film was brilliant. Mm, yeah. Who didn't grow up with that? I bet everybody in here would know every single song from The Sound of Music.
Yeah, it was a great film.
Yeah.
Almost as good as Gorky Park.
What's the story? Really? I listened to last week's show too. What's this about Sally's birthday? How come you didn't tell me? How come you didn't invite me?
Oh, yes, it was my birthday last week.
What were you,
55.
You're admitting it. You only look about 38.
No, I'm quite old.
Sally's very attractive, listeners. That's the only reason I'm here, for a thing. More Shakespeare.
You're so shallow, Cliff.
Let me fall asleep on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Director Peter Evans breathes new life into one of the greatest love stories ever told for Bell Shakespeare at the Arts Centre.
Oh, yes. Romeo and Juliet, of course.
I think it finishes soon.
I'm not sure. I know my daughter Pearl's going to see it this
week. I didn't know who the lovers were.
Wasn't there some...
It's the greatest love story ever.
Yeah, no, it's Romeo and Juliet.
Is it Romeo
and
Juliet?
Julieta.
Has there been some crucial change to the Bell Shakespeare group?
Yes, John Bell is now no longer its head.
All right.
Peter Evans. Yeah. Yeah. That's about all I've got to talk about today.
Really?
Yeah.
So what have you been doing this week?
By the way, I looked over, the YouTube songs, best songs.
Yes.
I looked over 4 years of them because, they only have about 4 seconds of each song.
Yeah.
The last 4 years, the songs have been terrible.
Have they?
Terrible. So I haven't come up with a song.
Oh, yeah. Haven't you? All right, then. Well, we'll miss that. We'll probably go straight to the news. You're going to have to join in on the news with us
no,
today,
I'm just going to cut this off and let you fill in the rest of the Are time you? Yourself because I'm in a grumpy mood.
Yeah, all
I
right.
haven't had my coffee. I'm going to a coffee shop to have a cup of coffee.
Well, that's a good idea. And make sure you have two.
Yeah, and Collingwood last, you know, it was so sickening.
Oh, dear.
Go Dees, and how are your feet now that you've been to the foot doctor?
My feet are all right. They're not cheap either, the foot doctor, but she's quite attractive, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's important to me.
Yeah.
I don't get much else. Okay, goodbye.
Oh!
See you, John.
We've got a bit of your song, Cliff. We have got a song for you.
Have you?
I think we're playing you a little bit of your song.
Is it a decent female?
Yeah, it is. She's blonde.
Blondie.
Yeah. Blondie.
See you later, Cliff.
Yeah,
thanks for coming in, Cliff.
See you, Sally.
It's time for the news, and this is the new news.
Yeah.
I found that really difficult
to say. The
current
news. I mean, here you are reading the news on the Mornington Peninsula while you're in San Francisco.
I know. It's a time-space continuum of some wacky level. Okay, so Keepers of Place, new works by the Papunya Chupi artists, is on at 45 Downstairs for a couple more days until June the 4th. And the Winter Salon is coming up Queen's Birthday weekend, 11th to the 13th at Whistlewood down here in Tux Road.
Country and Western, a Landscape Reimagined is on at MPRG, a combination of Indigenous and non-Indigenous imaginings of our national landscape.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a print exchange on there, relief printmaking by Australian artists.
Okay.
And that's on until the 3rd of July too.
FAC?
Yes.
If These Walls Could Talk.
That's right. That's the name of a new production coming in there.
Okay. And what is that, Sally?
That is, it's a... Theatre, circus skills and powerful storytelling all combined.
All right.
And it brings to life stories inhabited in a single apartment. It's been on at Gasworks in Albert Park, and it's coming to Frankston on June the 9th. We're going to be talking with Kate Fryer, the director and performer, in the coming weeks.
Circus skills. We're not concerned about the shish kebab, are we?
No, we're not concerned about it. Oh, I hope not. No, we're definitely not concerned about it. Dark Mofo's on, everybody, coming up later on this month. And Christian Wagstaff's House of Mirrors is part of it at Dark Park. Book your tickets. Accommodation is probably almost full. Things are selling out, and I know finding rooms getting a tough. Go to the website and have a look if you haven't already.
Linden, up in there in St Kilda.
Mm-hmm.
It's proud to unveil its latest exhibition, Wild Lands, running until Sunday the 17th of July. Wild Lands is a group exhibition with a selection of emerging and mid-career artists from Arts Project Australia. And I reckon it's worth having a bit of a look into that.
Yes, it is. It's a not-for-profit organisation that provides support for artists with intellectual disabilities, but it's promoted on a broad contemporary spectrum and represented in the mainstream art exhibition and events. So it's a pretty good project. I'm going to have a chat with them about their project, perhaps in a few weeks after I come back.
Right.
Yeah.
Because at the moment you're actually probably asleep.
I'm either asleep or I'm somewhere. I'm probably in Yosemite at the moment.
Oh, right.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, but you can catch up with the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime during the week. The show's also repeated on Wednesdays at 12, and you can find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday when I will actually be really back. Remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
We know what we like, Sally.
Yep, we sure do. Great show. Thanks, Brody.
Yeah, thanks, Brody. Go and do your hair, will you?